This week on the show, Apple sprouts a new core, iPods on planes, and charging by the bite. Right here on This Week in Media, number 96. Hey, everybody. We're back. I've given up. You know, that's just the way I start the show.
I don't make fun of you.
I know you make fun of me, but there's
no. No. We all, the last show made fun of
you. You said, hey, everyone. No. Is that what you did? You
we were just using Alex's voices. It was kind
of okay.
Funny.
It's okay.
But I wasn't on the show last week.
All right. Now this is John Foster that you're listening to, if you don't know.
Hello, everyone.
We have a double John going on here. So we have John Foster. We have John Flowers.
Hey, Alex. Excuse me. I wasn't on the show last week, but my sensitivity was.
Now, who was on the show? Liana Lehua.
Aloha.
was on the show. Did you enjoy the all-girls show?
Yeah, that was actually kind of fun. I was hoping Lane caught some of the chatter at the beginning because it really sounded like a hen house. It was awesome. It was so awesome. In a good way.
In a good way. Yeah. I thought that was kind of fun. It just happened to be that we had all those folks, and we've been really working on trying to get a more feminine influence on the show. And so we've got so many great people around. So I'm glad you came back. Obviously,
yes,
it wasn't too horrible.
You. Oh, no, it was a lot of fun. I like hanging out over here. This is fun.
We like having you over here. Yeah, definitely. So
you can tell us apart, right?
We sound differently, right?
Yes. If I close my eyes, I kind of go, okay, John is over here and John is over here.
Yeah, we're in mono.
Everyone listening has no idea what we're talking about.
Yeah, sorry.
All right. So we've got all kinds of fun news today. First of all, Apple is now. Is Apple going? Are they trying to go around Flash here? This is the new. It's new. It's been around. There's been rumors about it, but it percolated during WWDC, which is this Sprout Core. John, what is Sprout Core?
So. Everyone knows what the web has been for the last 10 years or so.
I hated it.
It's what I call a click wait experience. You click something, a little bit of data goes out to a server, and then you wait, and then a whole bunch of data comes back.
You know, they used to do that to mice for cheese.
So the problem is that when you're filling out a form and one thing on your form is wrong, well, it's got a round trip to get to the server and back to say, dude, you forgot to put in your state. I'm like, why did you ask me for the state when you know what the zip code is and you could derive it from that? Right. Anyway, that's a different story. But the idea is that every action is a round trip. And so we're largely ignoring the power of the desktop. So there's no reason why the desktop in front of you can't go and verify that a form is filled out correctly. Just have to have the power or the code live.
And it's not just that. It can move things around. It can do all this stuff. Because right now, anytime we change an image, anytime we change anything, it seems like, except for we're starting to see these Web 2.0 apps,
right.
these Ajax
apps. Ajax-enabled apps.
Where it's going to do a lot more. And we're seeing that with Flickr. We're seeing that, you know, when you're looking at that, when those things happen, when you can drag and drop, when you can put those things together, that's the kind of the...
Right. But, I mean, imagine that, you know, we have this cool technology, which is drag and drop, and we've had it for 25 years roughly as a user experience, but the web largely ignored it. They said, you know, we don't care about drag and drop,
right?
And that was because the standards of the browsers didn't allow this experience to happen. So imagine hooking up some of the desktop APIs or objects into the browser experience so that you can get a more application like thing on your desktop. Now, a good example of this is already out. It's called 280 Slides. And it's a application that was written using the frameworks that are called Objective-J. And they were able, this developer was able to make what is a thing that looks and
feels like an app.
Feels like an app. It looks like Keynote.
Right.
You can do real work in it. Mm-hmm. It's very quick in the way that it works. I mean, it downloads fast and you're doing work.
Right.
The cool thing about this is that when you extend this to other things, you look at this and you go, I don't have to download apps for my users anymore. I can just give them the URL in an email, and they can go, and we can deploy this across our whole network, and I don't have to install anything.
Well, and is this what Google's trying to do?
Well, this is what a lot of people are trying to do. So it's Google, it's Yahoo, it's
Microsoft.
And we've seen this with Air and Silverlight and the QT Core.
Now, but isn't Air and Silverlight, isn't that a heavier version of this? Because these are really standalone applications, aren't they?
Well, this stuff is being built with open standards. So we can do things with JavaScript. We don't have to have a proprietary language. We can do things. We can do formatting with CSS elements. We can have the framework of this isn't owned by anybody. It's everybody's. Mm-hmm. And so what happens is, like, so for example, if Flickr wanted to build a more iPhoto-like experience, it would be totally possible to do with these APIs.
Right. And what are the limits of the APIs? What can't they do?
Well,
if you're doing heavy multi-processing, I imagine it's,
you know,
it
was like, so for example, if you were going to,
you couldn't make Final Cut.
You couldn't make Final Cut because
you might be able to make iMovie?
Yeah, you might be able to make iMovie with this.
Mm-hmm. Well, do they have calls to the OpenGL? I mean, core video,
it's basically
stuff. I mean,
it's basically like, if you look at the Objective-J spec.
I mean, I know Java, you can call OpenGL from Java. Mm-hmm.
And there's a framework that QuickTime allows. So anything that QuickTime has in that Java layer, you can get to.
So all of this is getting put together, and Apple's version of this is Sprout Core? Is that the idea?
Well, the idea is that they've taken a bunch of open source projects, wrapped them together, given them the support from Apple Computer. So Apple's really good at bringing together things that are necessary for development. So, for example, it's a decision by somebody going, well, we don't need this superfluous call. We're not going to spend time with this. We need to clean this up so that instead of seven calls or seven different functions, it's one that makes sense.
Right. And instead of Perl, you get something like Objective-C.
Yeah.
And Objective-J is just the Java-like version of Objective-C.
So now, are you going to be able to build these applications within Apple's
within
development
Xcode.
Tools?
Yeah.
With Xcode? So you're not building web applications in Xcode, theoretically.
Right.
Yeah, I think all of this is really great, and you know, if there were a rainbow around every corner and a pot of gold at the end of every one of those rainbows, it would be wonderful. But the fact of the matter is, right now, today, we don't have internet connectivity in a way that would allow us to constantly be online. And so this forward motion toward applications being online, I just find frustrating.
Okay, well, let me give you an example of not having to be online. So, for example, every Mac that's shipped has server capabilities. It has Apache built into it. And so in order to deploy this in my office, all I have to do is turn Apache on one of those Macs, publish the IP address, or even better, use Bonjour to find that, and my app is deployed across my network without having to do any installs.
Right. I mean, and that's certainly great for large businesses or people who know how to do that. But I'm thinking of, as a consumer, if I want something like Adobe, like Photoshop, you know, the Photoshop Online, I forget what it's called.
Photoshop
Express.
Online.
Photoshop Elements. What was that?
Elements.
Elements.
Express.
Yeah, Express. Photoshop Express. I mean, it's great, but...
If
I want to use it on a plane, forget about it.
But right? I think that Photoshop Express on the web is three steps away from Photoshop on Air, which would be then a standalone application.
Right. I just wonder if we're not putting the cart before the horse a little bit right now. I mean, we don't have ubiquitous bandwidth. We don't have ubiquitous connectivity to the internet. I mean, we're starting to push all these things online. And don't get me wrong, I am the biggest fan of Google Maps that ever existed. The ability to drag a map around in an Ajax-y kind of way is, you know, it's fundamentally gorgeous and wonderful. But do I really want iTunes to be a web app that I have to actually connect to a server?
But the question is, do you have to be connected to use one of these apps? And if you're Air is an example of something that you don't have to be connected. You can use all the things that Air. Now, if you want to use the internet part of Air, and in the same way, I mean, when you're looking at iTunes as an example, you're really looking at an internet, it's a net application. I mean, it has a whole lot of features that work when you're not connected, and it has a couple features that only work when you are.
Well, there's no reason why these things couldn't be downloaded and live on your desktop and work just as if they were on your desktop, right? Here's the thing. It's just another development tool, and because these these functions are going to be built into the core of Safari, and they're going to be built into the core of WebKit. This is available to things beyond just Apple.
Right. So one of the advantages of this is that you could theoretically develop these simple applications and run them across Windows or possibly Linux, you know, using these different operations. And so that would give, it's kind of what the advantages of Air. I mean, one of the reasons we're really interested in Air is that we can develop something quickly and we can develop something effectively with kind of standard out-of-the-box stuff. And we know that it'll go cross-platform and it'll look exactly the same in both areas.
I think that this is in a way more revolutionary because have you ever worked with a bunch of people on a team and somebody is a Flash person and somebody is a real engineer? I mean, a traditional engineer. The two don't get along.
Right.
Because the Flash guy has an art background, generally has learned a little bit of coding, but isn't the brightest person.
Isn't the brightest light in the room.
No, because, you know, he happened to be, you know, he was an artist that happened to get exposed to code, really like it, basically was able to copy-paste his way into getting a job, and now he's expected to do, other kind of work. The Flash environment doesn't really lend itself to the team coding model where you have something like Subversion or a code check-in method, and the part of the guy being
so one of the artists of Sprout Core is that you're really just treating it like code.
Yeah, it's really code. You're using Xcode. You can check your stuff in and out. You can work with a multiple person team, and
is this a direct competitor to Flash and
no,
Air?
No, it's beyond
a whole different. It's beyond.
I mean, it's the thing is, if I'm a developer by virtue of doing it for a large part of my life, and I'm looking at this stuff going, you know, this is something to pay attention to. You know, when Flash came out, it was like, well, we should pay attention to this. And you start to do stuff with it, and you're like, well, I guess it's going to be good for advertising and animation and that kind of stuff, but I can't really build a real useful app in this. And besides, it's Flash, and people are going to go, oh, it's just Flash, or I have to install this. This is something that I'm very attracted to because I can make web-based applications without having to do this
crazy web stuff.
Idiocy of the way that the web worked.
Now, speaking of avoiding all the idiocy and moving on, I have something even more revolutionary than what you're talking about.
What's that?
iPod hookups on United International flights. To me, that's revolutionary. So,
I'm confused as to why this is even a story. I can plug my iPhone into.
Here's the deal. It's a story because I travel a lot, and my biggest complaint about being on the plane is I don't really want to watch what's on the video screen in front of me. Like, I don't have any interest.
Your iPod hooks up to the screen.
Yeah, this isn't charging your iPod. I can plug my iPod into an international flight on United, and I can watch the videos that are on my iPod on the screen in front of me. So I don't have to be sitting there sorting through whatever movies. And this is, I know this you'll, is, this is one this, small yeah. segment of the world, but it's a big game changer because a lot of the value add that JetBlue gives you or that Virgin America gives you or that Singapore Airlines gives you is their media service because it's a long flight. It's a 16-hour flight. It's a 12-hour flight. It's whatever it is. And you have to use that because you're generally your iPod or your computer won't last that long. So, you know, how do you deal with that? And by saying, you know, what we're going to do is we're going to give you some stuff if you don't have something. But a lot of us, you know, I got 160 gigs on my little, you know, on my travel iPod. You know, I have a lot of movies. I have a lot of music. I have whatever. I just want to watch those.
Hey, Alex, can I ask a question?
Yeah.
Is Snakes on a Plane on your iPod?
No.
See, that would be the only reason I would want to have this because then I could watch Snakes on a Plane on a plane.
Yeah. No, not only that. I would have all the terror plane ones, and I'd sit in the aisle seat and just watch them, you know, just to kind of make people crazy.
I think the addition of power to my seat is actually bigger for most people.
Well,
I think most people have a laptop. You know,
it is, but if you've sat in international flights to London, right? In coach.
Yes,
we like to call it the cattle section.
I guess I have, sure.
Okay, so I can't really open, just in case you're wondering, I can't really open my laptop. Like fully. Yeah, he's got his air. Now he's showing off his air. Yeah, yeah, yeah. But even that, in a British Airways coach, here's the problem is that when someone opens the seat and they back it up, all you can see is the screen.
Don't you have
you know, and you can't look down.
One of those seat blocker tools? Somebody made this little plastic gizmo that you can jam in between the seat and the tray, and then, right. then they try to move it back, and they're like,
"I call that
it's really small."
I call that call that my economist.
It's a wee.
Yeah, I just you roll up the economist and you set it in front of the seat right in front of you, and when someone goes back, you just kind of push, and you have here's the key. The key is that you let them go back far enough that they think it's working, but not so far that they fully use the seat's reclining capabilities.
I'm just saying that
gives you that extra 2 inches that you need to actually be able to watch it. Now, everyone sitting in front of me now will always look back and they'll see me and they'll go, "Oh, I'm going to wait until he's not looking."
That's that economist guy.
Yeah, it's the economist guy. So anyway, but this is I think this is really interesting because I think that, as I said, it's this. What I think this points to is this idea that people are personally owning their media. They don't really want to watch it from anywhere. Like when I go to my gym, I started persuading my gym to start adding iPod hookups to the bikes. You know, because they all have screens and they all have cable. And I was like, you know, I don't really want to watch the cable. I just want to plug my iPod in and watch whatever I want to watch. You know, and they started letting me put a hookup in, and then suddenly, you know, you start seeing it being used all the time by other people because they suddenly realize, oh, I don't have to watch cable. And I think this has a big deal when you talk about advertisers. This is problematic for them because as we continue to download more, right. as we start to take it with us all, you know, all the time, and stop listening or stop being available, you know, to watch or listen to something else, it could have a big impact.
I just want to know, Liana, you're probably closer to like a consumer than most of us. And does this seem like something that, you know, the vocal 1% is screaming for and the rest of the world just is okay with the, you know, 16 channels of options with, you know, 20 movies? Or do you think everyone has to have their iPod connected?
You know, I think people will now that there's a story out, but I don't know that anybody thought about it before outside of like guys like you in this room.
Yeah, I thought about it.
Or people, yeah, I'm sure Alex thought about it. But like, well, I mean, thinking about it too, about it too once I got on a Virgin America flight and the in-flight entertainment did not work. I'm like, okay, now I have to watch my iPod.
Right.
And it's such a small screen. But I think now that that's becoming more of a norm on flights, I feel like people would say, okay, you know what? I do have an iPod. It would be nice to watch it on a bigger screen. But like you were talking about before, I, you know, just as soon open up my laptop and use it, and then I have a couple of batteries, so on a 6-hour flight, I'm good. I'm also small, for anybody who doesn't know, so like I don't take up a lot of space, so somebody could like push their seat all the way back, and I still have room to exercise and stuff. So it never bothered me, so I never thought about it. But yeah, I would imagine now that people know that United is adding it, it might be more of a demand, but I don't know that
I think the thing is that once someone plugs their iPod in and it works that way, they'll want, and this is what all these airlines are trying to do, is they're trying to find something that for at least some period of time gives them a one-upmanship. You know, for a while I was like, oh, I love flying JetBlue because I can watch cable. You know, and then I wanted to fly Virgin America because it was better, you know, better media. You know,
better plus, period.
Better period.
I mean, yeah, nothing comes close.
Unless you're in row 8. anyway, so the that said, digital advertising is jumping. So this is we have TV has gone up a little bit, but digital advertising now is skyrocketing. Were you able to look at this? This is actually, it's too bad Daisy isn't here.
This is the front sale store.
One of the things I think it was interesting was the stat that we're going to jump in 2007. They said I think that the sales were something like 440 some million in advertising, and they're looking at it jumping to 7.2 billion in the next 5 years. That's a healthy curve. Now, a lot of this has to do with the fact that Hulu exists, you know, and other things, you know, that there are more of the conventional advertisers have just made more outlets. So
this is the media buy going from TV, which we're going to see a decline in, huge decline in the next 5 years because of the way that people consume media. Like the airplane story is a good example. You know, as people own their media and say that this is what I want to watch, then those eyeballs go away. Not that I ever use the word that way, but they stop watching. And so this 7.2 billion is basically in NBC or ABC's fall season as it is now. you know, to put it in perspective. So those normal dollars getting sucked out of TV go into other places because that's where
and right now what we're seeing is we didn't see TV upfronts, which are the, you know, the pre-orders. We didn't see them go down this year, but we did see them flatten.
Right.
You know, and so and we're only in probably a year or two away before we start seeing them go down.
Well, I guess I want to understand what digital outlets means because I read the article and I'm it's sort of nebulous because when you look at advertising possibilities all over, like for example at retail, the advertising that goes on the floor, the advertising that goes in the checkout line, the advertising that's on television screens that are around or LCD screens, and then the radio that go, you're listening to In This Place Radio.
It's really called that, isn't it?
No, I didn't want to call it a name, but it's like In This Place.
Right.
And so while you're there shopping, you might hear some, you know, the latest Green Day song, and then there'll be an ad. Hey, did you know over in aisle two, they've got this thing that you can buy?
Yeah, now and that whole idea of this thing you can buy, you know, the BBC now has, or someone leading the BBC has said that they're basically going to try to shut out any kind of product placement. Did you check this out, John?
Yeah, well, the only BBC show that I watch, it's Doctor Who, and they can't really have product placement on that show. Because it's kind of, you know, sometimes they're in Pompeii, sometimes they're far in the future. And so what are those products that they would place in those places that wouldn't look ridiculous?
It'd be a lot of scarves and trousers, I think.
And there's a lot of demand for this, the idea of being able to do product placement into a lot of these shows, because, and does it really damage the show if someone's drinking a Coke instead of a Pepsi?
Well, you know, the thing with product placement, I was giving some thought about this, is does the product placement work over a period of time? So the big issue that everyone has is that copyright isn't long enough because we have these properties that we may want to have in existence for 100 years and continue to make money off of. So if there's a product placement thing in this show that's 50 years old, is it quaint or is it stupid or is making an impression?
I think the people who are buying it don't really care. I mean, I think what they're looking at is what impact is this going to have over the next month.
But can you measure product placement at all? I think that this is very smart because if there is in fact somebody wearing a green sweater in a show and they paid $1 million for that, and then they didn't see any sales of green sweaters after that, then it doesn't work.
Well, but it's hard to tell whether people are buying it right then or whether it, you know, a lot of, in a branding campaign, oftentimes it's not a matter of getting people to do something. It's generating a goodwill about that company. I mean, one of the things that Apple is very good at, spends a lot of time and money on, is making sure that when the good guys have Macs. You know, I mean, and you'll see that a lot, you know, where there's a lot of Macs that, and you'll see that little, every time you see that Apple logo, you know, Apple did something to get it there. It's not done by accident. And you'll see Macintoshes there with a silver sticker over top of the Apple. That means Apple obviously didn't help. You know, and so there's a lot of effort that's put into product placement from Apple's point of view, and a lot of other companies. I mean, product placement has been around. I mean, guys smoking Marlboros long time ago, which is a good example of why not to have product placement.
Or that Jack guy driving a Ford or whatever he drives.
Right. Having a Ford Mustang in the show, and there's sometimes when you can see it, like when the in the last Bond movie, when he was driving this American something kind of semi sports car.
Would never drive that.
It was that was the problem. That's an example of product placement that kind of went awry. Is when he was on that island, and I can't think of what he was driving, but it was some Ford something or other. But it was clear enough that you could see the logo and everything else, and you're like, yeah, I wonder how much they paid to put their car in there. You know, that's the kind of
unless there's the missing scene where he's thrown the keys from the rental guy or something,
right?
To help explain away why he's driving this.
But the reason that he did it was the reason that they did it, I'm sure, is because of money. You know, and then you have the, you know, like in The Matrix, when you see that Cadillac that they're driving to get away, you know, Chevy, I think it was Chevy, gave him like 17 of those or 18 of those cars, you know, they're the only ones that existed, and I'm sure paid something as well to make sure they were part of that movie, you know, but that's, they're not trying to sell that car today. What they're trying to do is generate that, oh, that's cool, in the back of your head, and then that will be augmented with other things.
I didn't even notice the car.
It was just
see, it's that good.
No,
it's
but
that
no, good. I, like, no,
it went straight into your subconscious.
Yeah, but like I never, but I couldn't tell you what the brand was. I mean, it was just an object in the movie. It was a, it was the tool that got them to right. the other place.
Right.
I didn't notice that it was a, you know, a something.
Mm-hmm. Well, will product placement work for all products? Like you're saying, like a car, especially now people are thinking about gas. Knight Rider, which failed miserably, and I was sad about because I wanted it to work. Did it make me want to go out and buy a Shelby Mustang? I said, wow, that's cool. And then they had all those, they had commercials during the show where Michael Knight was in his car and doing cool stuff, and it's like, okay, that's cool. Now I need to go get a beer or whatever I needed to do. But
and I think it also depends on the expense. You know, I think right. when you have a product placement of something that is less expensive, when it's $50 or $100 or 100, you know, something in that range, people can react very quickly. I think we talked about it. I'm not going to go into it too much about the spoons at Oprah. That we talked about that.
Yeah, they're all going to ask for the link now. We're not putting it in the show.
You have to go back and listen to all of the episodes.
You have to go find.
For those of you didn't hear,
show
there was
notes.
Just a, there was this thing, this lazy spoon, and it was shown on Oprah. And when it was shown, the guy got crushed with orders. But that's an example of something that isn't very expensive. A lot of people saw it and they reacted. That's okay. And now that was in a show. But when you talk about having it in a you know, in Miami Vice or something like that, will it have that effect?
I don't know. I was looking at, you were talking about the Apple earlier. I was looking at something from the Washington Post by Sarah Kehaulani Gu. I guess that's how you pronounce it. Well, it looks sort of like your name. So I was looking at it, and my understanding and Sarah's understanding and the understanding from several other things I've read is that Apple has never once paid for product placement on television or in a film.
Could be possible. They may not have paid for it, but they've definitely supplied gear.
I'm sure there's some kind of relationship.
There's something going on. I mean, they're not doing it. The thing is, it's not worth it to choose it just because someone gave them the free computer. So there's, there's probably more. I mean,
well, there are a lot of Macs. There are a lot of Macs in Hollywood. I think that says a lot about it.
Yeah,
I mean,
but it's worth it for Apple. But it wouldn't be a filmmaker tends to be. There's two reasons a filmmaker leaves the logo open. Is one is obviously because they're trying to push something, but also because they're getting either paid to do it or they're getting a bunch of stuff to do it. So right. it might not be. That Apple paid for it, but the producer and the director and a bunch of other people may have Macs that they didn't have to pay for.
Could be, you know, just the art director really liked that it was silver.
Yeah, and maybe it is just soft skills. I mean, it could be just people just doing, just really making lots of friends and getting them in there. I'm just not buying it.
Lucian James, the president of Agenda Inc., is a brand consulting firm. She says that the people in 24 who were good guys, the reason that they use Macs is because Macs are... the thing that creative people use, and it suggests an artisticness.
Okay.
That they weren't actually paid. It's so okay. unbelievable.
Okay. And the bad guys were just cheap.
Yeah.
I'm sure
my BS meter is going ding, ding, ding.
I'm
ding,
sure
ding,
some,
ding,
yeah,
ding.
Somewhere in the background, there's like a, you know, four 2-ton trucks of Macs being unloaded onto the studio lot
right.
for everyone
right, now,
who
now
was
the,
in the show.
The, one of the things that's interesting about this is there are some stations that are trying to add more of this product placement into it and more interactive television. So that you can actually click on things that you're seeing. Is interactive television, I mean, people have been trying to do this for 15 years. Is this really going to go anywhere?
This is the Media and Advertising New York Times article?
Yeah.
I think if it's still not interruptive, people are saying they don't like interruptive media, and me having to, for example, this article that's in the Variety, I think it's the same one, where people use remotes to tag things they like and go back later. That's yeah. still interruptive to me. I'm looking at, like, you know, Angelina Jolie and Wanted has, I don't know, a dress that I want. I still have to think to take my focus away from the movie and hit a button on a remote, for example, to go back to later. I don't know.
I think it's just we're just untrained about it. I mean,
that's
true. If it seems disruptive now, but as you're sitting there and you've got the button and you just go, okay, click, you know, you're just like, it's just a reflex at some point.
It also depends on whether you saw it the first time or the second time. When I see a movie for the second or third time, a lot of times it's playing in some window in the corner while I'm doing something else. You know, it's not as, but that's not what TV is. TV is filling up the whole screen, right?
So this is like Dig for television. In a way, right? You're watching something and you see something and you're like, click, I'm going to dig that in a way.
Or I want to order it. I want more information.
Right.
I want,
but you're basically bookmarking it so you can go back later, right?
Well,
you're not interrupting the show.
Well, it depends. Some some of these iterations are actually stop the show. You can order it. You can do all those other things while you're watching.
That seems brain dead.
Now, when you're watching a movie, that doesn't make much sense. But when you're watching something like a Discovery Channel show or you're watching something else, it might make more sense where, you know, the stopping and right. getting it. There have been times when I've been watching Mythbusters and they pull out some tool and I really wish that I could remember what that was, and then I have to go find it, and then I have to figure it out. And
that means that you're watching Mythbusters in real time.
I know, it's very frustrating.
I tried to stop download the show, and then you can stop.
Exactly. Now, all of this, of course, puts more and more pressure on the PDP. Generally on the ISPs, and the ISPs are starting to push back. And we're not going to dive into this forever because Twit spent, I think,
70 minutes
talking,
and they
about
got
it.
Some stuff wrong, and the kids are correcting them as we speak.
What was wrong?
Well, the thing with
here's the deal is that what the ISPs are starting to experiment with is the idea that that we're going to start charging you for more than a certain amount, so more than 20 gigs, more than 40 gigs, more than whatever that number is. Obviously, the complaint is that for us as a media developer, is that this could eventually affect us pretty quickly because one of our shows might be 200 megs or it might be a gigabyte. That means that you can only, once you get over 40 shows, you start getting charged a dollar per.
Yeah, a dollar a gigabyte is what
dollar gigabyte, saying. Which is, can be exorbitant if you're downloading a lot of video.
Yeah, but I pay as a internet or as a on my server, mm-hmm. I pay approximately 18 cents a gigabyte to send out a gig to a user.
Okay, you spend 18 cents a gig. I spend two.
You spend $2?
2 cents.
2 cents. Okay, I'm using this as an example.
I'm just telling you that I got a better deal.
Fine. Okay. Okay, part of the thing is when I use a number, some of the time I'm using it as if I'm speaking to a client.
Just say X. Say N. So you're paying, right. you're paying N
so
for
I
bandwidth.
Pay, okay, let's say 20 cents.
N per gigabyte.
All right. So that the N per gigabyte. So that the user is having to pay a dollar means that somewhere along the way, somebody's made $1.80 or $1.20.
Right.
Between the two places.
Well, and the question is it really costing them that in the first place? That's the whole issue. Is I think a lot of people, it's one thing to say we're going to charge you incrementally for power or for so on and so forth because we created the power from somewhere. What they're charging you for is access to rails, right?
Sure.
Now, they're going to say that rails have a certain upkeep and everything else, but the idea is that you're paying for that upkeep when you pay your subscription.
I understand. The thing that I was going to say is that bits are power. Right, mm-hmm. it takes electricity to make those on offs get to here from here to there. So in a way, you have to look at it as power.
Okay.
Yeah, but the router's on whether it's moving 4 bits or 4 million bits.
I understand.
Well, it doesn't use more power to move.
No,
you know.
It doesn't. But I'm saying that there's power involved getting it there. So
right.
the analogy of its like power is very good.
Kind of.
I see. So if at 4 bits you have one router and at 4 million bits you have, let's say, 3 routers. Mm-hmm. So there's an upkeep cost for infrastructure, mm-hmm. but you also have theoretically more users using it. And Comcast's solution in the past was just to throttle you.
Right. Well, and the way that throttling happened was that somebody on a node would complain, "Hey, why is my internet slow?" And it wasn't really a robot. It really wasn't, you know, bandwidth monitoring. It was like somebody saying, "Why is this slow?" Somebody looks at the router tables and go, "Well, this one's got a lot of activity, so we'll just throttle this down for
now." Now my BS meter is going off. I think they have an automated system in place that throttles you. But
part of it is that it comes from a user complaining.
I see.
And then they turn it on,
or they started turning it on.
Now Google is going to try to help people make sure that they know at least what's going on. Because one of the big problems that we're having with all of this, of course, is that there is no transparency. So maybe this metering is a good way to do transparency. The problem they're going to have is that people like me would pick another service. If I knew that I was going to, you know, people will start shopping against how much bandwidth, especially after they get a big bill from Comcast or AT&T for $180 that they didn't know that they were going to pay. You know, that's the end of that, you know, that's the end of that consumer for the most part, right?
Well, Google's putting together this thing called an ISP throttling detector, and that's what you're sort of alluding to. The interesting mm-hmm. thing about the ISP throttling detector is, if I understand how it works, it basically tells you when your bandwidth slows down Well, here's the question I have. What is the, and this just seems like Google kind of like dropping a big piece of poo in the punch bowl at a party just to see what happens. Because the reality of this is, if you have, let's say you're using the internet and it's 7 o'clock at night, it's going to look to you like your bandwidth is being throttled, but in reality, your bandwidth is not being throttled. What's happening is
being shared.
Your bandwidth is being shared. And so you go suddenly from, you know, 300 or 400 KB a second to 50. Well, that's not because there's someone evil trying to shut you down. It's because everyone got home from work and, you know, they're on Hulu watching whatever they watch.
Well, but isn't there a pattern that you might be able to see if you're looking at throttling?
Well, is there?
We don't know. I mean, I think that's what Google's looking for is not just that you're getting less bandwidth. I could tell that with my iStat Pro. I can look at iStat menu or whatever, and I can tell you that I have a slow connection.
But is it slow because of throttling or because 17
I think that's what Google's trying to. I mean, it's easy to figure out whether I have fast or slow connections. The thing is looking for a pattern that might be something trying to slow you down or stop you or reset your connection those are the kind of things that I think that Google's trying to see. And I think, as I said, most of it's holding these ISPs accountable because the ISPs, of course, would prefer to have this happen quietly. You know, we're going to slowly tick off the top 5%, but we're not going to, a lot of them won't know what's happening to them. And the other folks, will be unaffected, so it won't bother them. The issue is that it's going to affect all of us as we start to watch more and more video online. And it affects us as producers if people become afraid of it. You know, people are afraid of running over too many minutes. They're going to be sitting there, not watching as much video, and that affects us.
I'm going to say that what I thought was a lot of bandwidth use a year ago is tiny compared to...
Well, that's the issue.
Right? And like, I watch my router with all the people in my office in a day, and the amount of gigs that are pulled down in a day is staggering. Right. Compared to it to a year ago. And, that means that the pipe coming in is getting all the bits all the time up and down.
Right. I'm gonna be that guy, and I apologize for this, but my prognostication on this is that this is Google's attempt to put something out there to show that everyone else is mean and evil and taking up bandwidth and throttling and doing all of these things to just stick it to the consumer. And the ploy is that within a year or 2 years after all of this throttling stuff explodes, Google's gonna have their own internet that you can become a part of, and they're gonna go, look, we don't throttle you.
And we'll join.
Just think it, yeah, exactly. And we'll join because, like lemmings, we've been, led to believe that everyone
lemmings.
Else is...
I mean, the thing is that Google has a different business model that probably works better for us than most of the... their business model is we would prefer you to have the bandwidth because we can sell you more stuff if you do.
Right. Meanwhile, we're going to track you with your, Gmail account while you're logging into it so we can serve up ads to you.
Yeah, well, that's...
So you can click on them, Liana, because that's what you want to do. You want to click on ads.
Well, yes. It seems like a good idea to have your email go to Gmail. I think that's something I don't want to have exposed.
I'm not a big Gmail fan myself. But anyway, so finally, we have one more tech talk, and that is the Dynamics battle. Dynamics. So I had to say that louder so that you could hear. Dynamics.
What?
That means it's louder.
And what?
It's quiet.
What are you saying?
It's quiet. And then it's louder.
I think we should have this part of the conversation like this.
No, I don't think we should have the whole conversation this way. I don't think it's really going to work.
Because you're going to compress the crap out of it anyway, and it's going to all come up.
And that's the problem. That's what we're talking about. Compression, compression, compression. So when you get this podcast, when you're listening to this podcast, of course, it's been compressed. But it's been compressed twice. Two different ways. One way is that we made it smaller by making it AAC squished. Or FP3, and that's a squish. Yeah, that's a squish compression. And then the second compression, actually it's the first compression, is that we compress the audio, meaning that we stretch it. Yeah. So what we do is we say anything over a certain volume, what we're going to do is we're going to drop that. We're going to do it at some rate, 2:1, 3:1, 4:1, whatever that is, and we're going to reduce it, and then we're going to take the entire thing and stretch it back out again. And that compression is that makes it reduces the contrast between the soft stuff and the loud stuff, which makes it easier for you to understand if our mics are a little off or whatever. It kind of cleans all of that up, makes it more intelligible. What's wrong with that?
It's just better. It's just better, isn't it?
Well, to a point. I mean, it makes it all sound the same, so you don't have to keep adjusting your volume. When you're in headphones, of course, you want that to be consistent. But when you're listening to music, some people believe that music should be loud. It should be at the maximum volume so that it sounds okay on your car stereo, FM radio, or whatever that is. So it's filled and it sounds loud. Mm. The problem with that is that there's no range. It's all this little tiny bandwidth, little tiny area where the highs and lows are stuck together or mashed together. A good example of this is take anything modern. For example, Green Day, American Idiot, is, if you look at these, there's just a band, a black band. And compare it with Pink Floyd, The Wall, or Dark Side of the Moon, or one of the other albums.
Trick of a Tail.
The White Album. You know, lots of these things from the old, you know, that were produced back in the day. And you can see the waveform. There's highs and lows. There's different things that you can see in the music. And it's actually easy to track where stuff is happening because you can see it visually.
And a lot of this happened over the last decade, right? I mean, that's last
everybody
10 or 15
wants it
years.
Loud. Can you make it loud? Can you turn it to 11? You know, make it one louder. Well, why not just turn it all the way up? But it's going. It's one louder.
Yeah. And were you going to say something?
I was just going to say, you know, when you do that too, it makes if you turn the volume up, you know, by basically blowing everything out to the, you know, the peaks and sort of levelizing everything, if you will, and then you compress it, it actually compresses to a lot smaller file. I mean, you can compress things a lot more, and we're all worried about bandwidth and size and all this stuff. So you've got all this compression going on. Well, the problem is, and I sort of alluded to this a few weeks ago on This Week in Media, there are a lot of studies that have been done, especially there's something called Meyer Sound Labs in Berkeley, which is totally amazing. John Meyer is, or Mayer, I think it's Meyer, unbelievable report about how the part of your brain that's being stimulated by listening to this stuff is a part that actually makes people angry.
And evil.
Well, okay.
Oh, it makes them, that explains so much.
It creates something called music listening fatigue. And there's this study where, a different part of, you know, a different hemisphere, different part of your brain is being activated because you're filling in gaps that have been compressed. And they've been compressed to the point where, you know, there's so much you have to fill in that it causes this sort of anger. And he tracks it back to, I don't know if you've noticed this, but in the 80s, when I was growing up, people would listen to music and they would be happy and smiley and in their car and sort of bebopping along.
Shiny, happy people.
Listening to really high fidelity music, listening to really good sound. And now people are listening to NPR, they're listening to podcasts, or listening to these things that are compressed. The number of, you know, incidents of road rage have gone up. People are generally happier as a result.
I'm going to attack that just a little bit.
Sure.
One is that as someone who worked at a radio station, everything that comes out of a radio station is compressed. You know, I mean, going to the,
right,
to, you know, compressed pretty heavily on the way out.
Right. What,
so if you're listening
more
to it on the
compressed
radio,
now, is what I'm saying. Much more.
Well, NPR is not. Right. NPR is actually, that's what they pride themselves in. Right. Very,
but most NPR listeners are a lot less aggravated after listening to NPR than somebody like who listens to another competing type of program.
Well,
because
it's
more compressed even more.
Yeah. I mean, I definitely get that it's more compressed. I think the reason there's road rage is because there's more cars and there's more congestion than there was 15 years ago.
Right, and I'm not suggesting that road rage is the result of compression.
There's a lot of those drivers out there that had it coming.
Right.
Sorry.
I'm not. It's not a straw man argument. I'm not suggesting that we have road rage because of compression. What I'm suggesting is that the part of your brain that gets exercised to fill in the gaps on all of this compression actually does generate a sense of anger in people, mm-hmm. and that's scientifically provable.
Yeah, it's.
Thank you, John Meyer.
I mean,
from Berkeley.
It's an interesting process here. I mean, because it is something that we do listen to. I think we all listen to music in a much different way since the MP3.
Well, you talk about Trick of a Tail like it was the best thing ever created. Do you think that that's because A, it was the best thing ever created, or B, everything that's been created since then is devolved to the point where it's more and more compressed, and nothing has that kind of fidelity that activates the pleasure centers in your brain the way that Trick of a Tail did.
I know. Trick of a Tail was such a great album.
You know,
that's all I have to say. If you're listening here, you should go. I don't even know if it's available, but the MP3 won't be the same. It won't be the same as listening to the album. I'm just warning you now.
It really
it's
isn't.
Not the same.
And people who don't really know that much about audio, I downloaded something off iTunes, and then I downloaded the same thing off Amazon, and I played the two songs back to back, and the a person who knows nothing about audio on the second one said, my God, that second version was so much better. Is that a different recording?
Mm-hmm.
It's not, though. It's the exact same recording. It just exercises a different part of your brain.
Well, it's not only that.
It allows you to really enjoy it more because you're not filling in so many
blanks.
Everybody's
going to want to know what those songs are, or that song is, so they can do that trick.
It was Polly by Nirvana. You know, Polly Want a Cracker. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, so go up and check that out, and you can try to do it
more,
yourself.
What is it?
But isn't it?
Are the file sizes similar?
The question is: do people really care? I mean, here's the issue: we can talk about all this, but do people really care that the stuff is being compressed? You know,
they don't, but they should.
They should.
And what are people listening with? I mean, does it matter if I've got my iPod?
If you have your earbuds in, it may not make a big difference.
Well, I have, you know, and that's the one thing is that a lot of people are listening through these little earbuds, you know, and I have these. You know, these headphones that kind of feel like they're surgically implanted in my ears when I stick them in. You know, my experience of music is much different. My sensitivity to it is much different than when I have, you know, crap little headphones that ship with your iPhone or iPod or whatever.
But if you're listening,
you shouldn't really put those in your
ears. If you're
ears,
listening
by the way.
In your car, that's a different experience because you've got road noise, you've got the car shape, all the things that go with that. And it's just not...
I was going to say, I like to use my headphones in my car, too. It really sounds great. You know, there's a problem with ambulances, but other than that, it's just fine.
But the idea is that I think that music could be anything in a car, and it wouldn't matter if it was, you know, if it was the analog recording that came off of a record being played back on some awesome digital player. The car itself will wreck the experience.
Well, but isn't this the issue though? Is that all of us are listening to this music mobily? We're listening to it in our car. We're listening to it while we walk. We listen to it with a lot of other things, and we just kind of want the music there. And this has been what's happening is that we keep on, you know, 128, which is a horrible compression size, you know, for music, became the thing that we got kind of used to, probably because of Napster more than anything else. And but people using Napster, the first 10 million decided that 128 was enough for their dial-ups to back up, to send stuff back and forth, and that's what we have, you know. And so can we go back? Is there a possibility? You know, are we going to go back to something of higher fidelity, or is there going to be some kind of revolution, or are we just going to keep on going down the path we're in?
Go down the path we're in.
Oh yeah. Unfortunately, we're going to keep going down the path we're on unless someone comes out with, you know, some kind of study that links
that to cancer.
Yeah, exactly. That's
really
exactly where I was going.
They're going to have to link right. MP3s to cancer. I'd like to link
a surgeon general's warning,
you know, like
causes brain tumors.
I'd like
until
to take this
happens.
Moment to say that I believe that you double your risk of cancer with MP3s, but you reduce it in half when you listen to AAC.
Well, that's because they don't have the swishy sounds in the background.
Exactly. So I'd like to start this study.
Swishies make me crazy.
Yeah, the swishies are kind of crazy.
Yeah, I'm kind of bummed out about it. I mean, I think about that movie Idiocracy, and just people are fed. People are starting to use what we're being fed, versus, I mean, I've heard talk before about going and buying, for example, a CD versus downloading it and the different quality that you get. And I'll go out and buy the CD because I do like that quality. I'm somebody who does listen to music that way. And so I don't necessarily just take what is being fed, but a lot of people who are not in the know will do that. And like you're saying, I just see it continuing to go down because it's cheaper and people are just going, I just like it because it's cheaper.
Well, now at least our listening audience knows better.
Well, and if they want absolute immutable proof, they should go and buy the original Red Hot Chili Peppers Californication.
Okay.
And then go download the Red Hot Chili Peppers Californication off Amazon.
Okay.
The original CD is more compressed than the Amazon remaster.
Really?
Yeah. The original CD sounds like absolute crap. Okay. And the Amazon remaster from the original is unbelievably better.
Wow. What are they doing at Amazon?
They're just taking the original master and not compressing it. Right. Not in the same way, right?
Right, right.
So I would encourage everyone to do that.
Amazon.com.
I would literally call Californication on CD unlistenable compared to the Amazon version.
And this show is brought to you by Amazon.
Really fun.
At AMAZON. No, this is not brought to you by Amazon. We just, but we did.
But we do say thank you for providing much higher quality,
yeah, you know, Amazon's cool.
Music.
So it'd be really cool if we didn't have to actually go to their website and we could use Sprout Core or Air or something that and download their songs without actually
or if Apple grabbed a clue and followed suit.
It's not Apple's issue. It's the record companies are not giving Apple DRM free 256 because they're trying to give Amazon a chance to compete, because what they want is competition so that they have leverage again, and Apple doesn't have any. You know, Apple has all the leverage at the moment, and the record companies feel emasculated.
But the record company is not preventing Apple from having a DRM protected higher quality version.
Yeah, they are. Yeah. that's the problem.
That is sad and pathetic.
Apple has what they can put up there. Apple would put all of them at DRM free 256 if they could. It's the record company.
Right, no, I'm saying DRM'd. They can't do a higher quality version of DRM.
No, I don't think so. I think that the whole idea that the record company, because the record companies supply all that stuff to them, the whole idea that Apple has here is to be able to the record companies are trying to pull Apple back so that they can have somebody else compete with them, because they want more leverage on pricing and all the other stuff. And so they're not giving Apple anything. They won't give Apple any room to move, and they're trying to help everybody else. And I don't know if it's going to work. I mean, until someone else gets a good player that looks like, that acts like iTunes, a net app, not a web page, they don't have a chance, in my opinion.
Sprout Core.
There you go. Use Apple's own technology against it.
Exactly.
There you go. Unless they do it first. So, John, where can people find you?
Which John?
Whichever one jumps in first.
You first. You can find me at lifezero.org. But I real quick, since this is a show about media, I want to just say a special shout out to Ken Bell, who came out with something called The Dog Files, which, if you haven't seen it, totally unbelievable. The first one is called Ice Cream Social. And I ignore Life Zero. Go to thedogfiles.com and check it out. It's unbelievable.
Oh, by the way, before we get any further, I just want to mention that when you're mentioning friends, and I just popped into my head, is that Justine, Ezra Guy Justine, who and I are on the circuit this week.
So when you're watching The Dog Files and you're done, go watch The Circuit.
Exactly. Watch The Dog Files and then watch The Circuit. So we're on The Circuit. I'm interviewing Justine, so it's mostly her. Nice. I'm just sitting there with a microphone. So
which version of her, E or I?
I. Oh. The E, yeah. E Justine is not on it. It was all I Justine. And
E
so,
is funnier.
Yeah, definitely. So check that out. Liana, where can people find you?
You can find me at girlsgonegeek.tv.
Is that your only show?
No, we're doing several other. Actually, I lied. You know what? If you go, I always say you can go to lianalehua.com, then we run into the issue of people not being able to spell it. Third base.
Second base, actually.
Second base, you're right.
I don't know who's third.
No, I've taken over iLife Zone a little bit from Scott. Okay. And we're actually starting a new show this week for moms who are geeky, and we have two geeky moms. So yeah, we're starting that on Sunday.
Nice.
Yeah.
Talk about sonograms?
We will. No, I hope not, because I know nothing about it. By the way, I don't have any kids. I'm actually there just kind of hosting and cruising along. But, I hope to, be able to influence kids like Kai,
Yeah.
I'll have kids around me. So, Excellent. It'll help me, help me help other people with the technology, I guess.
John, where can people find you?
MacBreakTech.com.
You have a new one out yet?
We did one on preview, and before that we did one on
something special.
Back to my Mac.
There you go.
Yeah, we
there
did one go. On Back to My Mac.
God, it took a little while to kind of shake through the cobwebs.
No, I'm like, did I get the ISP show up yet? Yeah. No.
Right, there we go. This mess that you've been listening to is This Week in Media. We are over and out.